one way or the other. By bedtime, the matter still had not been resolved. After I got Jeremy settled in for the night, I rolled out some blankets to sleep on the couch. A sleep that would refuse to come, of course. Instead, I lay there staring at a shadow cast against the wall by the light from the oven clock. As fatigue settled in, that shadow blurred, and I saw the mugshot face of Toke Talbert staring at me. I closed my eyes, and the words of the press release invaded my thoughts. Joseph Talbert found dead in a barn. My dad, dead. All of my life, I had been pretending that I didn't care if my father existed, but now that he might be dead, he became real to me. Learning about the death of this man had ripped open the rotted planks that I had used to hide him. In the quiet of that night, as my thoughts found their way past years of anger and resentment, one sad truth remained. I wanted to know my father. Around midnight, as I lay staring at that shadow, I heard the creak of our bedroom door, and then the padding of feet approaching the couch. Lila came and sat on the edge of the cushion beside me. I can't sleep, she said. Me neither. I leaned up on my elbow to make room for her. I'm sorry about all this, I said. I can't really explain why, but I just need to go to Buckley.
I know, she said. I'm sorry I freaked out.
I rubbed my hand down the soft skin of her arm as she spoke.
I'm really stressed about this exam. I know you have to go. I just wish the timing weren't so...
I reached my arms around her waist and pulled her closer to me.
I won't be gone long.
I felt her stiffen at those words. Then she relaxed, and she kissed the top of my head.
Come to bed,
she said. Chapter 6. I woke with the sun the next morning and carefully slipped out of bed so as not to disturb Lila's sleep or the delicate truce we had reached the night before. I'm not sure that Lila actually came around to my way of thinking so much as she took the steps that she needed to take to get some sleep. There was still much that went unsaid, details that could upset a true meeting of the minds. But I went ahead and filled in all of those blanks in my favor. She agreed that I should go to Buckley. At least those were the words that I heard, so I was going. I brewed a pot of coffee for the road and slid a few snacks into my bag. Buckley was 2.5 hours away, closer to 3 with the city's morning traffic. A couple stale donuts would tide me over. I also put a call into Allison's voicemail to let her know that I was taking a personal day, maybe 2. I couldn't imagine her having a problem with that, given the cloud that had been following me around lately. I poured my coffee into a travel mug and snuck back into the bedroom to give Lila a kiss goodbye. I expected to find her asleep, but instead, she was sitting on the edge of the bed holding what, in the dim light of morning, looked like an envelope. I ignored the incongruity of the scene and leaned in to give her a kiss. She did not look up to receive me, so I kissed the top of her head.
You okay?
I asked.
No,
she whispered. I sat on the bed beside her, expecting that we were about to have another go-around about my leaving, but her attention remained focused on the envelope in her hand.
Joe, there's something we need to talk about.
She didn't look at me when she spoke, and the seriousness in her tone chilled me.
Last night, when I told you that you should talk to your mother about your dad,
Lila fiddled with the envelope, kneading it the way Jeremy rubs the back of his knuckles when he's upset. I could see cursive writing on its face, but I could not make out any name on it.
What's that?
I said, nodding at the envelope.
I know you told me that you never wanted to hear from your mom again.
And you know why, I said.
Joe, she's your mother.
What's in your hand? I knew what it was, even before she answered.
It's from Kathy.
Throw it away. I stood up. No mail, no phone calls. No communication. That's the rule, remember? She's out of our lives, and it's got to stay that way.
Just read it.
Lila held the letter out to me.
Did you read it?
Yes.
And you should too.
I backed away from her, as though the paper she held might come to life and claw me.
When did you get that?
Lila paused and looked at the floor.
Lila, how long have you had that letter? It came just before Christmas. Jesus Christ! 7 months? You've had that for... I couldn't finish my sentence. Lila and I have had disagreements over the years, but this? Stunned, I backed out of the room. At first, Lila didn't follow after me. I paused as I picked up my bag, fighting against my urge to be somewhere away from her, waiting for her to utter an apology. When none came, I picked up my bag and made for the door, forgetting all about my coffee sitting on the kitchen counter. I had reached the door to our apartment before I heard the words I was hoping to hear. "Joe, wait!" I paused in the doorway, my back to her, my ears listening to the familiar sound of her bare feet on the carpet. When she caught up to me, she took hold of my arm, and I turned to face her, expecting to see remorse in her eyes. Not the anger that met me. Before I could say a word, she shoved the letter into my hand and took a step back. "You can read it, or you can throw it away," she said. This was not the act of contrition I had been expecting. "Who are you?" I said. "How could you—" A clutter of harsh words tumbled through my head, jostling to get past my lips, but I held them back, knowing that nothing good could come from speaking. I looked at Lila and said, "I gotta go." Then I turned and walked away. Once in my car, I wadded up the letter and threw it to the floor, adding to the mess of empty water bottles and crumpled up fast food bags on the passenger side of my car. The morning traffic on Snelling crawled at a pace that would normally have had me cursing the vehicles around me, but I barely noticed the gridlock as thoughts of Lila shoving Kathy's letter into my hands stabbed at me. It was the same gesture used by that short turd of a man who served me with the lawsuit. I couldn't hold anything against the bald man, though. He was only doing his job. But Lila's gesture came with a layer of betrayal that blindsided me. She had been holding on to Kathy's letter for 7 months. She had read it. She broke the only rule I asked of her. I fumed and sputtered as I worked my way south, the curtain of my anger never really parting until I passed through the first tier of suburbs on my way out of the Twin Cities. Only then did I pause to question whether I could have been at fault for what happened. But try as I might, I couldn't see that I'd done anything wrong. Lila can't hold it against me that I got upset. She knew the destruction that my mother caused. She also knew what my mother was still capable of doing if we let her back in. Lila had been there from the beginning. She was there the day that we rescued Jeremy from that woman. Hell, Lila drove the getaway car. As I left Shakopee, Highway 169 thinned out enough that I set my cruise control and hit the scan on my radio, hoping to find some music to block out the thoughts of my mother and the letter and my fight with Lila. I inhaled a few deep breaths, halted my radio scan on something classical, and relaxed my grip on the steering wheel. I had 2 hours more to go. Chapter 7. My trip took me south along the Minnesota River Valley for an hour or so, and then west into farm country, a fairly treeless part of the state painted green with crops of corn and soybeans. I traveled on a 2-lane highway where each mile looked exactly like the last mile. My travel hindered occasionally by a small town, some not even big enough to support their own gas station. The world had turned so flat that I could see Buckley, or at least the water tower, from a good 8 miles away. I expected the town to grow bigger as I drew closer, but it never really did. As a county seat, Buckley had been laid out around the courthouse, with small stores lining the 4 bordering streets. The highway that I'd been traveling turned into Main Street and ran along the front of the courthouse. I drove around the square, curious to see what Buckley might have to offer a ne'er-do-well like Toke Talbert. What drew him here? And, more important, what kept him here? I made a mental note of the stores and shops. Antiques, hardware, a cafe, a bar, used clothing, the normal fare. It never occurred to me that Buckley might not have a motel until I'd completed my loop and found none. I noticed the sheriff's office across the street from the courthouse and parked in front of it. I hadn't planned to make that my first stop, but if nothing else, I might get directions to some type of lodging. The door to the sheriff's office opened into a small lobby where, at the other end, a lady sat at a desk behind bulletproof glass. To my left, a thick metal door marked Visitor told me that the jail was also part of the building.
To my right, a wooden door led, I assumed, to the interior of the sheriff's office. I approached the receptionist, a woman in her 40s, who glanced up at me for a second before turning her attention back to something more important on her computer screen. She made me wait a full 30 seconds before she asked, "Can I help you?" "I'm looking for a motel or hotel or someplace that I can stay here in Buckley." "Did you try the Caspian Inn?" "I didn't try anything," I said. "Where's the Caspian Inn?" "It's 2 blocks that way," she pointed over her shoulder. "Do you know the address?" She looked at me as though I just asked her how to tie my own shoe and said, "It's on Maple, this street right here." She held her left arm out and made a sweeping motion with her finger. I was about to leave, but a thought came to me, and I said, "While I'm here, could you tell me who the lead investigator is in the Toke Talbert case?" Now I had her attention. She shifted in her chair to face me and said, "And you are?" "I'm a reporter with the Associated Press." That was a true statement, but Allison would chew me out if she knew that I was using my AP credentials to get the skinny on my dad's death. The receptionist picked up the phone and whispered into the receiver. "No," I said, waving my hands to stop her. "I don't want to meet them now. I just want a name." She ignored me and kept whispering. Then she hung up the phone and pointed to a row of chairs next to the entrance. "Have a seat and someone will be with you." I didn't want to go into this interview cold. I had hoped to get some background on Toke before sitting down with the investigator. I wanted to steer the conversation, not be led through it. I opened my mouth to beg out of the meeting, but stopped when a deputy entered the receptionist's office and spoke to the woman in quiet tones, both of them studying me as they talked. The deputy, a big guy with a serious face and a buzz cut, disappeared from the reception office and a moment later popped through the door beside me, his thumbs tucked into his belt.
"Can I help you?"
he asked. I stood up. "I'm a reporter with the Associated Press in Minneapolis. I'm here about the death of a man named, I think he went by Toke Talbert. I was hoping to speak to the lead investigator. Would that be you, Deputy?" I looked at the name clipped to his shirt. "Calder?"
"Associated Press? Why does the Associated Press care about a guy like Toke Talbert?"
If I had been truthful, I would have said that the Associated Press didn't give a hoot about a guy like Toke Talbert, and that my editor would have my hide if she knew what I was doing. I briefly pictured Allison with the lawsuit papers in her hand, and a "what were you thinking" expression on her face reprimanding me for poking my nose into a story that I had no business covering. I shook off that thought by remembering that I had no intention of writing a story. Of course, Deputy Calder didn't have to know that. I answered the deputy by saying, "There's no such thing as an unimportant murder." Calder crossed his thick arms over his chest and looked dismissive.
"Murder? I don't recall any information being released about this being a murder."
"The press release mentioned foul play. I figured that to be a murder."
"Are you saying that this wasn't a murder?" "I'm not saying anything. You have identification?"
Crap. I reached into my back pocket, pulled out my AP card, and handed it to Deputy Calder. He read the card, his eyebrows lifting about the time he read my name. He looked at me, and then at the card, then back and forth one more time, before his eyes finally settled hard on my face.
"Your name is Joe Talbert?"
I nodded.
"You related to Toke?"
I didn't answer.
"Christ, we got friggin' Talberts crawling out of the woodwork today."
Calder leaned his chin into the mic attached to his shoulder and said,
"Sheriff, could you meet me in the conference room? I have something here you might want to see."
The answer came back,
10-4. "Mr. Talbert, would you mind coming with me?"
"Why?"
"We'd like to ask you a few questions."
Then with feigned politeness, he added,
"Please."
He waved me through the door and into an open space that held 3 metal desks running in a row along the cinder block wall. Straight ahead was an office with a sign beside its door that read J.T. Kimball, Sheriff. To my right, behind a large windowed wall, was a conference room, which I assumed doubled as an interrogation room given the cameras mounted to the ceiling. Calder offered me a chair in the conference room, one facing the cameras, then stepped out, closing the door behind him. Through the glass wall, I watched another deputy enter the frame. He and Deputy Calder appeared to be about the same age, late 40s. But where Calder had the body of a powerlifter, the second deputy had the sleek build of a triathlete. They chatted and pointed at me for a minute before a rotund man wearing a white shirt joined them. That had to be Sheriff Kimball. Calder again mouthed words that I couldn't read, showing the sheriff my AP credentials. The three of them exchanged a few more words and then came in.
"Mr. Talbert, I'm Sheriff Kimball," said the man in the white shirt. "This is Deputy Nathan Calder."
He pointed at the big guy.
"And this is Deputy Jeb Lewis."
They all three sat down, with Kimball directly across the table from me.
"You wouldn't happen to have a driver's license on you?"
"I would," I said.
Kimball waited for me to pull out my wallet, but I remained still.
"Could I take a look at it?"
he said finally. "Am I free to leave?" Kimball looked at Calder, who gave a slight shrug. Then Kimball said,
"Of course you can leave. You're not under arrest. We're just a little curious about something. I have a card here that gives your name as Joseph Talbert. I would like to confirm that you are who this card says you are. Is that okay?"
I reached into my pocket and pulled out my driver's license, handing it to Sheriff Kimball. He looked at it, compared the picture to my face, and handed my license and AP card to Deputy Lewis, who stood up and left the room with them. Kimball said to me,
"You told Nathan here that you're looking into the murder of Toke Talbert. You know his real name, don't you?"
"I do," I said.
Through the glass, I could see Deputy Jeb sitting at one of the desks, probably running my driver's license information.
"You have the same name as him,"
Kimball continued.
"Is that a coincidence, or are you possibly related?"
I looked at Calder, then back at Kimball, and said, "I have reason to believe that Toke Talbert is my father."
"Reason to believe?"
"I never met the man," I said. "He got my mom pregnant, and when she refused to abort me, he punched her in the stomach and left town. At least, that's what I've been able to piece together from the police reports."
"And yet, your mother seemed to think enough of Joe Talbert Sr. to give you the man's name."
"My mom has a strange sense of humor," I said. "So tell me, Sheriff, was my father murdered?"
"Where were you on the night before last, say around midnight or so?"
I cocked my head back, caught off guard by the question. "What are you talking about?"
"Just need to button a couple things up. You understand."
"No, I don't understand. You think that I..."
"We don't think anything," Kimball said. "But you have to admit, it's a little strange. Toke turns up dead, and then boom, all these relatives start showing up."
"Relatives? Plural?" I asked. Deputy Jeb re-entered the conference room, handed my driver's license to me, and then handed some papers to Kimball. Jeb took the seat farthest away, his eyes studying me with quiet curiosity. Nathan Calder, on the other hand, stared at me like I was an overdue lunch. "I would also like to know how Angel is doing."
"I'm her brother, and..." "Hold on a second," Sheriff Kimball said. "We don't know that you're related to anyone here."
"If I'm Toke's son, then..."
If you're Toke's kid. "We need to know that you are an actual relative before we can pass out anything as private as medical information. We wouldn't be doing our jobs if we gave information like that to a reporter just because he claims to be related. If it turns out that you're her brother, then you can get in line with any other relatives and we can go from there."
"What other relatives are you talking about?"
"While you're here, can you give me your whereabouts 2 nights ago?
"You can't think that I killed Toke? I didn't even know that the guy was alive until I saw the press release yesterday."
"He ran out on your mother, didn't he? Something like that might cause resentment."
"Everybody runs out on my mother. Even me," I said. "I can't hold that against him."
"And he punched your mother in the gut when she was pregnant with you. Sounds like he tried to abort you. What about that?" "And don't forget about the inheritance," Calder added.
Kimball gave the deputy a look that caused Calder to slump back into his chair. "What inheritance?" I asked.
"Look, son,"
Kimball leaned in.
"I don't think you're involved here, but I've got a job to do and I aim to do it. You understand. I just need to know if you were in the area 2 nights ago. That's not asking too much, is it?
The word inheritance threw me off my game. I wanted to ask Calder what he was talking about, but the scolding glance Kimball had thrown him told me that I'd get nothing. So, I answered Kimball's question. 2 nights ago, I was in my apartment, asleep. My girlfriend can verify that. Kimball slid a piece of paper and a pen to me.
Can you give us her contact information?
I wrote Lila's name and phone number on the paper and slid it back to the sheriff. Now tell me, was Toke murdered? Kimball leaned back in his chair and rubbed the loose skin on his neck with the back of his hand.
We're going to do an updated press release this afternoon. That release will confirm that Toke Talbert was the subject of a homicide.
How was he killed?
Can't tell you.
Is there a suspect? Besides me, of course.
Can't say.
Is his daughter a suspect? Kimball looked at his deputies. Then he stood and hitched his pants up.
You know I can't answer any of those questions, Mr. Talbert.
I'd appreciate it if you called me Joe.
Okay, Joe. And I would appreciate it if you'd be so kind as to voluntarily give us a sample of your DNA.
My DNA? Why?
Whether or not you have Toke's blood running through you may be of interest to the investigation, just buttoning things up. You understand.
My first reaction was to object to Kimball's request. I knew that they couldn't take my DNA without a search warrant. But it occurred to me that Toke might not be my father. I mean, I only had my mother's word on the matter. This might be my only chance to settle that question for good. In the end, the curiosity of it all won out, and I agreed to give a DNA sample. Kimball assigned the task to Jeb, the quiet deputy. All three left the room together, and Jeb returned with a swab kit. He leaned against the side of the table as he opened the package. I said, "That other deputy, Nathan, said something about Talbert's coming out of the woodwork. What did he mean by that?"
"Just that you're the second Talbert to drop by today."
"Who's the other one?" I asked. Jeb stuck the long-stemmed cotton swab into my mouth and swirled the tip against my cheek.
"Charlie, Toke's brother. He dropped by this morning wanting to know what happened to Toke."
I waited for Jeb to finish scraping my cheek, then said, "Did you question him about where he was 2 nights ago?"
"You ask a lot of questions."
"I'm a reporter."
"We've got it under control."
"So you know who killed Toke?"
"I think everyone in town knows who killed Toke."
"Who?" He smiled.
"I'm one of the few people who can't say. We have a suspect, but that's about all I can tell you."
His eyes lifted to the camera mounted on the ceiling in the corner of the room.
"Buckley's a small town, Joe. Most folks have a pretty good idea of what happened to Toke."
"So why take my DNA if you have this wrapped up?"
"Because if you are Toke's son, that could change the math."
He slid the stick with my cheek cells in it into his sleeve and sealed it.
"Who knows?"
he said with a sly grin.
"We might be looking at this all wrong."
Chapter 8. I had no trouble finding the Caspian Inn. It was, as the receptionist had said, a couple of blocks down the street she waved at. I didn't expect too much in the way of accommodations, and those expectations were barely met. One level, 10 rooms on each side, back to back, with an exterior painted bright yellow to distract from the overall decrepitude of the place. Room number 8, my room, had water stains in the ceiling and chips of grout missing from the bathroom tile. The one window to the outside, to the extent you could see around the air conditioner, gave a grand view of the gravel parking lot and looked as though it hadn't been washed since the Ford administration. But the room had 2 comfortable beds, and that was more than I needed. I lay on one of the beds, and my thoughts immediately walked back to the sheriff's office, to Deputy Calder, and the word he used, inheritance, a word that seemed out of place in any discussion of my family. Nothing I'd come across so far suggested that Toke Talbert would die with more than a month's rent in his pocket. And then there was his brother Charlie, who I'd never even heard of. If Toke was my father, It meant that I had an uncle wandering around town. Maybe he'd be able to fill me in on what kind of man my dad had been. The Caspian Inn didn't have Wi-Fi, so I turned on my phone with the intention of looking up what I could about Charlie Talbert and saw that I had missed a call from Lila. I contemplated whether to call her back, a hesitation I'd never had before. I didn't know if I was ready to open that discussion again. How could she have read that letter from my mother? I had drawn a single line in the sand. No contact with Kathy Nelson. A simple rule, easy to follow. We don't give her our phone numbers. We don't open her letters. We give her no chance to worm her way back into our lives. Did Lila forget the extortion? The meth-induced ravings? Did she forget how Kathy let her shit-eating boyfriend hit Jeremy? I didn't forget the bruises, and I sure as hell didn't forget Larry. The first time I saw a bruise, it was a thin line on Jeremy's back. I gave Larry a stern warning to never touch my brother again, and with me being a bouncer back then, it seemed fitting that my warning came with an abrasion to Larry's nose. But to be fair, things would not have become physical had Larry not gotten in my face. He actually poked at me for addressing him in my chosen tone. The way I saw it, I had no choice but to take him to the ground and pressed his face into the grit of the sidewalk. That should have been the end of it, but apparently Larry was a slow learner. The night that I took Jeremy away, kidnapped him, as my mom told the judge at the guardianship hearing, Larry had punched Jeremy in the face, causing a bruise that nearly swelled my brother's eye shut. That night, as Lila and I drove to Austin, we never actually discussed what we would do. I think we both just knew. I stormed into my mother's apartment without saying a word to her or to Larry. Once in Jeremy's room, I threw some of his clothing into a pillowcase and was leading him out of the house when Larry stepped in front of me. I saw what was happening, so I sent Jeremy outside, where Lila was waiting for him. My mother made a show of her token resistance, screaming at me and crying that Larry didn't mean to hurt Jeremy. I ignored her ranting and focused on Larry. We both knew this had nothing to do with him wanting to keep Jeremy around and everything to do with having a second go at me. Repayment for the raspberry I gave him. Larry raised his fists, arms jutting out, knuckles pointing up. I probably had other options, but I didn't wait for those thoughts to find a footing. Instead, I gave Larry a quick kick to the side of his knee, sending him to the floor howling through the pain of a torn ACL. We've had Jeremy ever since then, and there hasn't been a day when he wasn't protected and cared for. He was safe because Kathy was out of our lives. She could never touch him unless we slipped up and let that trouble find us again. That's why we had the rule. Lila, who doted on my brother like he was her own, should have known that better than anyone. She'd let her guard down, that's all. We could fix that. I picked up my phone and returned the call. Hi, Joe. Lila spoke in a soft, hesitant voice. Hi. I waited for her to talk, giving her the opportunity to offer up an explanation or maybe even an apology. Instead, I got a long, silent pause. Then she said, That was a shitty thing you did today. What I did? I couldn't stop my tone from turning hot. What do you mean, what I did? You walked away. You turned your back on me and walked away. You didn't even give me a chance to explain. What's to explain? You lied to me.
I didn't lie.
You opened a letter from my mother. We had an agreement.
No, we had a rule. A rule that you made without asking me. There was no agreement.
She's my mother. I'm the one she screwed over. You don't get a vote on that.
Is that how it is? You make the rules and I shut up and do as I'm told? Is that how you see me?
No, Lila, that's not how I see you. You know better than that.
When it comes to your mother, I'm not sure I do. You're playing right into her hands. Give one inch and before you know it, she'll be calling me to bail her out again, or she'll find some way to extort money. My mother's a lost cause.
There's no such thing as a lost cause. Yes, there is. My mother is one.
People can change, Joe.
Not Kathy. I've known her all my life. The only changing she did was to get worse. People like her don't change. She's a drunk. An addict. She's mentally unstable. A combination like that doesn't change. They may hide it for a while, but the monster always comes back. That's just a fact. The phone went silent, and I waited for Lila to speak. The silence went on long enough that I glanced at the face of my phone to see that we were still connected. Then she said, "Is that what you think of me?"
"You?
No, that's not... Did you forget that I'm a drunk? I'm mentally unstable. Remember? I have the scars to prove it. Did you forget that I used to cut myself?" I had seen her scars on our first date. Tiny striations descending off her shoulder in neat rows. In time, I would learn about her high school days, how she fell into drinking and partying, and how that led to promiscuity and blackouts, and cutting her arms to deal with the pain. But there was another demon, one that had opened the gate for all the rest, one that she kept hidden from everyone except me. I understood why she had once sought to numb her pain with alcohol, how the sting of a razor blade against her skin could feel like a salve. I understood the hurt that twisted its tendrils around every bad decision she'd ever made. But I also understood that Lila faced her demons and beat them. My mother was not Lila. Where Lila had built a wall to keep out the beast, my mother laid down a welcome mat. But what I said just now could have applied to Lila as easily as it did to my mother. Christ, I was an idiot. "You're not my mother," I said. "You were a kid. A teenager. You pulled yourself out of it. You haven't touched a drop of alcohol in, what, 8 years now?" "But it's a part of who I am, Joe." "You wanted to change. My mother has never wanted to change, and she never will."
"I am the same person. You understand that, don't you? You act like there's some kind of baptismal font that we drunks can walk through to change who we are. Wretched on one side, but saved on the other. That's not how it works."
"You're not a drunk, Lila. You're not..."
"Why is it so hard for you to think that maybe your mother can change?"
"I know my mother."
"You haven't spoken to her in years. How do you know?"
"What makes you think she is capable of change?" I said. "One letter?"
"No, not just one letter."
Now it was my turn to pause as I tried to decipher what that meant. Then I asked, "Are there more letters?"
"No."
"What then?"
"I talked to her, on the phone."
"She called you? How did she get your number?"
"I called her after I read her letter."
"You called her?"
"I did."
I let my phone drop away from my ear. For 7 months, Lila had been living with me as though nothing had changed. Eating with me, laughing with me, sleeping with me, all the while hiding this secret. I felt like I had no idea who my girlfriend was anymore. I looked down to find my phone resting in my lap, and I pressed the red dot to end the call. Chapter 9. Lila spoke to my mother. I should have asked how many times, but why would that matter? The damage was done. Kathy had discovered a crack in our wall, and she would work it open with that same slow force that weeds use to split stones. She would sink her roots deeper and deeper into our lives until the tiny cracks became fissures and then chasms too wide to cross. She would find angles and traps. She would create havoc and start fights, while always painting herself as the victim. My mother never missed a trick. In truth, I never actually intended to seek guardianship of Jeremy after we rescued him. I guess I thought that Kathy might leave us alone if we took Jeremy, but not his Social Security money. I mean, what more could she want? I took the burden and left behind all the benefits. She should have been happy. She should have left us alone. But that was asking too much, I guess. When I kicked Larry in the knee that night, I thought I broke it. I didn't care at the time, but I should have known that Kathy would use it against me. I found out that it was an ACL tear when I received a letter from my mother telling me how lucky I was that they didn't bring in the cops. But in exchange for her and Larry's silence, she wanted me to pay cash for what I did to him. She framed it in terms of reimbursement for his medical expenses, but she did little to hide the extortion. Pay her money whenever she demanded, and this matter won't go to the police. In her letter, she didn't bother to ask how Jeremy's eye was doing. That would step on her narrative. She kept the fact that Larry punched Jeremy in the face out of the letters, as though by not putting it in, she could deny that the punch even happened. I don't think I ever felt more rage in my life. She didn't care about Jeremy. She didn't give a rat's ass about anything except getting money from me, as if Jeremy's disability checks weren't enough. I refused her demands, of course. I took pictures of Jeremy's eye, and both Lila and I wrote detailed accounts of what happened that night, in case we would ever need to recount the events in court. Kathy could threaten to call the cops all she wanted to, but I knew that Larry had a criminal record, and they would never risk the tables getting turned on them by bringing in the authorities. Kathy's threats, veiled or otherwise, fell on deaf ears until the day came that she threatened to take Jeremy back, legally, if we didn't pay her some money. That's when Lila and I took our first hard look at fighting for guardianship of Jeremy. Even with my mother's many problems, getting guardianship of him seemed an uphill battle. That is, until she got arrested for possessing meth. On a particularly hot July night, Kathy's neighbors called the police because she and Larry were screaming at each other again, the caller telling 911 that it sounded like someone was getting murdered. I know this because I read the reports and attached them to my guardianship petition. When the cops entered the house to break up the fight, they found 30 grams of methamphetamine on a coffee table. Of all the adjectives I'd conjured up over the years to describe my mother, meth head had never crossed my mind. Kathy had always been volatile, but in those years with Larry, she had vanished inside the husk of someone that I didn't recognize. It was as if she wore her demons on her skin, the crazy no longer content to swing on vines in her head. On those few occasions when I saw her, she looked like she hadn't slept for days, and she would pace around, picking at her arms and face. Looking back now, I should have known that she was using meth. But who would think that of their mother? Even after that arrest, I held off filing for guardianship, waiting to see if things might finally change. They didn't. The court released her from jail into a treatment facility. She wrote me a letter from there, demanding that I return Jeremy to her once she finished treatment. She didn't make this request because she loved her son, but because no one would send the mother of an autistic boy to prison. I couldn't believe that she would actually admit her scheme in writing. Instead of responding to that letter, I called my lawyer and told her to proceed with the guardianship petition. When they served the papers on Kathy, she went nuts, absconding from the treatment center and showing up at our apartment. Lila was the one to answer the door that day, and was so stunned when she saw my mother that she lost the presence of mind to shut the door in Kathy's face. My mother tried to push past Lila, which caused Lila to scream my name. Kathy was tiny and frail by this point, and I had little difficulty pushing her into the hallway, sending her stumbling to the floor as I closed and locked the door. Lila took Jeremy to his bedroom and sang to him while I called the police. As we waited for the cops, Kathy remained outside our door screaming at me, accusing me of assaulting her and demanding that I hand over Jeremy. I didn't know this at the time, but leaving treatment when you've been furloughed there from jail is considered an escape, another felony to add to her list. The officers who came to haul her away had been in touch with the courthouse in Austin and knew her status. They dragged Kathy out of the building, her insults echoing off the walls. That was the last time I would see her until the hearing. But I did receive one more letter from my mother, this one sent with the return address of the Mower County Jail. I didn't have to read it to know what it would say. My mother made her hatred of me perfectly clear as the police officers dragged her away in handcuffs. That would be the first letter I would throw into the garbage unopened. Looking back now, I was naive to think that storming into my mother's apartment and pulling Jeremy out would have been the end of it. Even having her arrested and dragged away from my door did little to get her attention. Those were but the first salvos in a battle that would scorch the earth between us, our fight devolving from shots fired across a desolate no man's land to a hand-to-hand slog. In the end, I would be the one to deliver the blow that would destroy what little remained of our relationship. Chapter 10. I did my best to brush the bad memories of my mother aside and refocus my attention on the life and death of Toke Talbert. Deputy Jeb said that everyone knew who killed Toke. If that was true, then I knew where to look for that answer. Having spent much of my life around bars, either working in them or hauling my mother home from them, I knew that the best place to learn local scuttlebutt would be the town's watering hole. The bar I saw when doing my short tour around the town square wasn't far from my motel. So I left my car at the motel and walked. The bar, the Snipe's Nest, had very few windows along its century-old exterior. Dark, huddled on the street corner like a stubborn vagrant. I knew that place. I could have sketched the floor plan on a napkin before I walked through the door. A bar running half of its length, stools bolted to the floor, and a brass footrail. There'd be booths running down the long wall and high tops in front, a black tin ceiling and sticky floors. It was the kind of place where town gossip would float through the air like dust motes. It was just before the lunch hour, so the place stood mostly empty. One man in his late 40s, wearing a suit jacket and khakis, sat at the end of the bar typing on a laptop. On the other end, two old-timers complained loudly about some chicken operation that was bringing all those damned Mexicans to town. The bartender was an attractive woman, my age, maybe a little younger, with long cinnamon hair and deep eyes that held steady on me as I walked up. She wore a black t-shirt, its short sleeves revealing toned arms, a small tattoo of a candle decorating her left bicep. Beneath the candle, I could see some cursive writing, but couldn't make out what it said.
"What can I get you, stranger?"
she asked.
"Just a Coke," I said.
She poured my drink and turned to go talk to the old-timers.
"Excuse me," I said. "I was wondering if you could help me out a bit."
She returned her attention to me.
"What you need?"
"I'm in town doing some research on that death that happened 2 nights ago." The guy in the khakis sat up and made no bones about turning his attention to my conversation. The old man to my left also stopped jabbering and listened in. I said, "His name was Toke Talbert. Did you know him?" She looked at the old-timers and then back to me.
"Everyone around here knew Toke."
"What can you tell me about him?" I asked.
"Who's asking?"
"My name is Joe. I work for the Associated Press."
"Associated Press, huh?"
She held out a hand to shake.
"How do you do, Joe? I'm Vicky Pike, shortstop for the Minnesota Twins."
I shook her hand and accepted her jab. Then I pulled out my wallet and for the second time that day, crossed a small ethical line by showing my AP credentials. This time, I covered my last name with my finger.
"So what's it like playing for the Twins?" I asked. "You really are a reporter."
I returned my card to my wallet.
"Is your name really Vicky Pike?"
She smiled.
"Yes, it is."
"Well, Vicky, I'm looking for a little background."
"Shouldn't you be at the sheriff's office asking those kinds of questions?"
"I find that I can get better information by talking to people without badges, people like you. I bet you know everything that goes on in this town."
"Ain't much to know, but I hear stuff,"
Vicky said. "Tell me what you know about Toke Talbert."
"Toke Talbert was an asshole," she said, dropping her smile. "He's dead, and it ain't a bad thing."
I don't know what I was expecting, but her candor surprised me. I found myself wanting to defend the man who had once punched my mother in the gut, but I resisted. "Did you know him well?"
"You didn't have to know Toke Talbert well to know that he was an asshole."
Vicky turned toward the old-timers.
"Bill, what did you think of Toke Talbert?"
"He was an asshole,"
one of the men said. The other guy nodded in agreement.
"See,"
Vicky said.
"I'm not speaking ill of the dead. I'm just giving you the facts."
"Why?"
"Because you asked."
"No, why was he an asshole?"
"Born that way would be my bet."
I paused to put together a more coherent question. "What I mean is, what kinds of things did he do to make people believe he was an asshole?" The guy that Vicky referred to as Bill spoke up.
"He cut down two of Connie Albert's walnut trees 5 years back. Just cut them down in broad daylight. Didn't like the nuts falling on his property. Told the sheriff some cock and bull story that he thought those trees were on his side of the property line. Never got charged with nothing."
The second guy leaned into the bar so that he could talk past Bill and said,
"Yeah, and last year he shot Karen Halverson's cat. Saw it crossing the street toward his property, shot it with a .22.
"Kill it?"
Bill asked.
"He shot it with a .22.
Bill said,
"That don't mean nothing. I shot a cat with a .22 once. Still see it running out my barn every now and again."
"That's because you can't shoot worth shit,"
the other man said with a laugh. They then began a debate on their respective shooting skills, and Vicky turned to me with a smug expression, her opinion vindicated.
I don't think there's a person in this town that he hasn't pissed off at one time or another.
How about you? I asked. What did he do to piss you off? Vicky looked at me as though I'd crossed some line.
What business would that be of yours?
None, I guess.
What kind of story are you writing, anyway? Why would a reporter care about a dead man out here in Timbuktu?
I gave her question some thought before pulling out my AP card again, this time showing it to her with my last name, Uncovered. She looked at the card, and then at me.
Talbert? Are you related to Toke?
I'm pretty sure that I'm his son. The man in khakis coughed and then closed his laptop. I could feel his stare without having to turn to look. The two old-timers stopped their bickering and fixed their eyes on me as well. Vicky laid my card on the bar.
I didn't know Toke had a son, she said,
her tone not as harsh as it had been a few seconds earlier.
He never mentioned you.
Then, as an afterthought, she added,
I'm sorry for calling him an asshole.
Don't be. I'm not sure that I disagree with you. He kind of disowned my mother and me.
Is that why you're here? Looking for your father?
Honestly, I'm not 100% sure why I'm here. I guess I'm just curious. You have any idea who might have killed him? She glanced at Bill and his friend as if looking for permission to share a secret. Then she said,
They think Moody Lynch killed Toke. They've been looking all over the county for him.
Who's Moody Lynch?
Wait, you know about Angel, right?
Toke's daughter, yeah.
Moody is Angel's boyfriend. He's got a bad reputation with the cops. They think he's trash, so they pull him over every chance they get, always looking for drugs in his car or something.
They ever find any?
No. Moody's too smart. He might be the son of white trash, but he's no dummy. Just the opposite. I heard that he was a decent student in high school before he dropped out. Never saw the need for a diploma if all he wants to do is hunt and fish. Why do the cops think Moody killed Toke? Bad blood between them two.
How come?
Moody was dating Angel. I guess that was reason enough for Toke.
How is Angel? I heard something happened to her the same night Toke died. Vicky looked at me as if she were about to tell me that my dog got run over.
You don't know, do you?
Know what?
I live across the road from Toke. He and Jeannie and Angel moved into the farmhouse after Jeannie's old man died. That's where Toke was killed. In the barn. Someone bashed his skull in. I was across the road, watching when they carried Angel out of the house. She was on one of them gurneys.
Did someone attack her, too?
Word around town is that she tried to commit suicide. That might be true, or it might not. You hear a lot of stuff, but I can tell you that they took her off in an ambulance because I saw that with my own eyes.
Bill said,
My daughter's one of the EMTs that took her up to Mankato. Said that girl was in pretty bad shape. Died a couple times on the trip up there.
Do you have a library in town? I asked.
It ain't much, but we got one. Go down to Oliva's Antiques, she said, pointing south. Take a right and you're there.
I stood and tossed a five on the bar. Just cover it?
Yeah, Vicky said. Stop by any time.
I walked to the front door, and as I passed the man in the khakis, he stood up and followed me. Chapter 11. I stepped into the midday sun, paused to get my bearings, and let my eyes adjust. I had seen all of his antiques earlier and thought it to be to my right. I was about to head that way when the man in khakis came out of the bar behind me.
Excuse me, he said. You got a second?
I turned and squinted at him. He was about my height, 5'10", but heavy and thick, like a tree trunk. I would put him around twice my age, with a touch of gray in his tight, curly hair. His white teeth and tanned skin suggested that he worked hard on his appearance, though he had a crooked nose and a flat face that looked like he'd been hit hard with a shovel.
Sure, I said. I didn't mean to eavesdrop in there, but did you say that your name is Joe Talbert?
That's correct. He began eyeing me up and down as if studying me for a test, We stood on the sidewalk in an awkward silence, him with his arms folded across his chest, me with my hands shoved in my pockets, enough room between us that anyone looking at us from a distance could see the discomfort that filled that space.
I don't think so,
he said finally.
You don't think so what?
I don't think you're a Talbert. At least you're no relation to the Joe Talbert who died here two nights ago.
Is that a fact? I said.
He pursed his lips and nodded his head as if satisfied with his answer.
Yep, he said. I could see right through you.
And who are you again? I asked.
I'm Joe Talbert's brother.
Uncle Charlie? I said.
I'm not your uncle anything, and you aren't Joe's son. My brother didn't have a son. He only had one kid. I don't know what your angle is here, but your con won't work. They have ways of testing those things nowadays. You ever heard of DNA?
You ever heard of Kathy Nelson? I said.
The expression on his face flipped from smug to confused, and he eyed me up and down again, this time probably looking for traces of my mother in me. Then, as if some slot machine in his head finally stopped spinning, he took half a step back and said,
Bullshit.
So you know her?
Yeah, I know her,
he said.
I knew her real well back in high school. All the boys did. If Kathy Nelson's your mother, then there's no telling who your father might be.
He laughed, and I found myself in the bizarre position of wanting to defend my mother's honor, a task for which I was wholly unqualified.
If you think you're Joe's kid because Kathy Nelson says so, boy, have you been duped.
Look, asshole, I hold no illusions that my mother...
Hold on there, boy.
His smile fell away, and he stepped toward me with stones for eyes.
I don't take kindly to being called names. I don't care who you think you are, and I don't care what kind of game you're playing, but if you go to insulting me like that, we're going to have a problem.
His attack caught me off guard, and I lost my voice.
I didn't say anything about your mother that wasn't the truth. Now, you may think that her lies give you some kind of standing to stake a claim, but her words don't mean shit. I'm here to take care of this family. My family. I got this under control, so you may as well go back to whatever hole you crawled out of, because there's nothing for you here in Buckley.
I didn't come here to stake any claim.
My words sounded overly apologetic, so I summoned a touch of anger into my chest. I'm just trying to figure out who my father was. You got a problem with that?
Your father wasn't Joe Talbert.
He took another step closer and pointed his finger at my face.
Get that through your head.
I hadn't noticed the squad car that rolled to a stop across the street until I heard the door close. I turned to see Deputy Jeb Lewis making his way toward us. Charlie saw it too. And in a flash, he had slapped a salesman's smile onto his face.
What's going on, boys?
Jeb said.
Nothing, deputy,
Charlie said.
We were just having a friendly chat.
Jeb said.
It didn't look like a friendly chat.
That's just the heat,
Charlie said.
Makes my face flush red for no good reason.
Jeb stopped walking when he reached Charlie.
Well, maybe you might want to head inside where there's air conditioning,
he said, pointing at the snipe's nest. Charlie broadened his smile and held his hand out for Jeb to shake.
That sounds like an excellent idea.
Jeb shook the man's hand. Then Charlie turned his smile to me and reached out to shake my hand. I hesitated at first, but then raised my hand up and he gripped it hard and gave it a short shake.
Good to meet you, Joe.
I didn't know what to think as Charlie backtracked his way into the snipe's nest. Jeb waited until Charlie was inside before turning to me and saying,
Let's have a talk.
Chapter 12. Jeb and I walked across the street to his squad car, where he leaned against the front fender and pushed his sunglasses up the bridge of his nose.
What was that all about?
He asked.
Family squabble, I said. You know Charlie? I've heard of him, but never met him until he stopped by this morning.
If you don't mind me asking, what did you hear about him? Jeb chewed on my question before he answered.
I was friends with Jeannie, Toke's wife, I remember her telling me some years back that Joe had a brother, and from what I understood, Joe and Charlie hadn't been on good terms since they were kids.
Did you ask Charlie where he was 2 nights ago?
We asked. And? We're looking into it.
The same way you're looking into me.
We wouldn't be doing our jobs if we didn't ask those kinds of questions. No stone unturned, as they say.
You guys are thinking that Moody Lynch is your man? Jeb smiled.
It didn't take you long to come up with that one.
I'm a reporter. It's what I do. Besides, that's probably the worst kept secret in town.
You understand that I can't confirm anything, even if I wanted to.
Another squad car pulled out of the parking lot of the sheriff's office, heading our way at a slow roll. Deputy Calder gave a nod to Jeb as he passed, but for me, he had nothing. Are you sure it's okay for you to be seen talking to me? I said.
Why wouldn't it be okay?
I leaned up against the squad car next to Jeb. I get the feeling that Deputy Calder isn't a fan of mine. Jeb spoke in a slow rhythm that made me wonder if the man had ever been in a hurry in his life. His words seemed softened by the heat of the day, like butter left on the table.
Nathan's all right. I've known him since grade school. He could stand to work on his people skills a bit. But trust me, there's no better man to have on your side when things get hairy.
So when he accuses me of murdering my father, that's just bad people skills?
It's his first homicide. He'll settle down.
You've never handled a murder before?
I have. Nathan and the sheriff, well, there isn't much need for killing in this part of the country.
But you've handled homicides?
I did 8 years in the Army, the last two in the Criminal Investigation Command.
Maybe you should be in charge of this investigation, then.
If I have input, the sheriff is more than happy to listen, but this is his show.
Well, tell the sheriff that I think you should give a hard look at Charlie. There's something wrong with that guy.
What were you and Charlie squabbling about?
I didn't want to tell him the truth, that we were arguing about my mother's bad reputation, so I focused on something else Charlie had said. He accused me of wanting to stake a claim in something. He acted like I should know what he was talking about, but I don't have the foggiest, I said. I get the feeling I'm missing something. Jeb folded his arms across his chest and turned his eyes to the pavement, his head slowly drifting back and forth as he gathered his thoughts. Then he said,
This morning, Charlie told us that he plans to seek guardianship of Angel. I think most people see that as a fine idea. Hell, he's already met with social services to get the background investigation started, and he hasn't even filed a petition yet.
I take it you don't see it as such a good thing?
Jeannie didn't like Charlie. She never told me why, but she didn't trust him. If I recall, I think she once called him a soulless human being. Now, I never met the man before today, but if Jeannie had that opinion of him, it makes it all the more likely that he's only here to get his hands on the money.
What money?
The inheritance. The Hicks estate.
Deputy Calder said something about an inheritance when you guys were interrogating me this morning. What's that all about?
You call that an interrogation? Hell, that was nothing.
Deputy, you're dodging my question. What's going on?
Call me Jeb.
Okay, Jeb, why does Deputy Calder think that I killed Toke Talbert for an inheritance?
You really don't know, do you?
No, I don't. What's he talking about?
Where do I start?
Jeb bit his lip as he pondered this answer, letting the seconds tick away to the point that I wanted to nudge the man. Then he said,
In a way, it's all Nathan Calder's fault. At least that's how I see it.
Come again?
Keep in mind, this was back when I was still in the service, but the story I heard is that Nathan pulled this car over for a DUI, and the driver turned out to be Toke Talbert. He was just passing through town, had no reason to be here, but he ended up going to jail.
I thought back to the mugshot Allison had given to me. That would have been his arrest for DUI here in Buckley. His last arrest.
Because it was his third offense, we took his car through a forfeiture action. Toke was living out of that car. After he got out of jail, he had no way to leave town. Looking back now, I think everyone wishes that we'd just given him his car back and told him to keep driving.
People say that Toke was an asshole, I said. Jeb gave me a sideways glance and a grin.
You got that right.
So how does a drifter like that come to have money?
The way they all do. He married into it. He got a job as a body man down at Dub's Repair.
Jeb gave a nod down the street as if I should be familiar with the establishment.